listener production.
This is Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suda. Join us each week as we break down one issue in global politics so that you can understand what's going on in the world right now and what's likely to happen in the future. Our host, Dr. Keith Suda, is one of Australia's leading commentators on global affairs and geopolitics. My name is Sasha Barbagat. I'm a journalist. On October 7, just a few weeks ago, the ugly, decades-long conflict involving Israel and Palestine flared again. Hamas-backed forces launched an attack on Israel, with 1,400 people killed. In response, Israel launched missile strikes on Gaza and established a total blockade on the territory. The war continues to rage, and so far, 8,000 people from Palestine have lost their lives, many of them innocent civilians. This ugly feud is complicated, with roots that extend back centuries. But those of us looking on from the comfort of the Western world are asking, how will this end? What are the likely outcomes? And will we ever see peace between these sides? Well, who better to answer that than Keith Suda himself, who has written a piece detailing the four outcomes he thinks could prove true. Keith, thanks for being here today. I think we need to start with a brief history lesson. Obviously, this conflict goes back a long, long time. Could you explain to us the brief history of Gaza and thus the conflict between Israel and Palestine?
Yeah, so Gaza itself is an old trading post. So it has a very long and distinguished history if you're an archaeologist. The piece of land that we're talking about is not very large. It's about 400 square kilometres. So it's a very small piece of land and has a population of about 2 million Palestinians. And then the other part of Palestine consists of the West Bank, which rather confusingly is on the eastern side of Israel. And that's on the West Bank of the Jordan River. And that has somewhere of the order of, say, 3 million Palestinians living there. There's no land corridor between the two entities. The territory had centuries under Turkish or Ottoman control. The Jews would say, well, look, they've been there since the time of the Old Testament. The Muslims are fairly recent. They're only 1,300 years old as a religious faith, but they're the ones who sort of settled. The Jews have been scattered on various occasions by Romans and other imperial forces. So it's very much Arab-held territory with Jews present, but not running the show. The Jews haven't run the Holy Land since, say, the year AD 70, when the Romans destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. They made a later stand at Masada in the south, so that was a smaller operation. So we're looking at territory which Muslims would say really belongs to them by rights of having been on there most extensively, most recently in history. In World War One, Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, sided with the Germans. And at the end of World War One, the Germans and their allies had their empires broken up. So Britain and France in particular acquired real estate. So in the case of Israel, the Holy Land, that whole area became a mandate for Britain to look after and, in theory, to put on the road to independence. So the area was controlled by Britain with a predominantly Islamic population. Then with the rise of Hitler in 1933 in Germany, more Jews were having to flee Germany and some of them went to the Holy Land and started buying up some of the land there. And that we then, in the late 1930s, get the social tensions between the Jewish population that's arriving and the Palestinians. And the British said, look, what we'll do is we'll just divide the whole land into two countries. Mm-hmm. And you'd have a Jewish area and an Islamic area. The Zionists, the Jewish organization, the Zionists said, yeah, we're happy with that. A Grand Mufti in Jerusalem, the Islamic leader, said, no, we will not do a two-state solution. World War II comes along. After World War II, Britain hands the problem over to the new United Nations, saying, we give up, we can't cope with this problem.
Yeah.
There is a joke that the British Empire provided most of the early work for the United Nations. So not only in Israel, but also elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So The British get out. Again, the two-state solution proposal is revived, again rejected by the Islamic world, but accepted by the Jewish settlers. And we've had a succession of conflicts over the 75 years from which the State of Israel was formed in 1948. And generally speaking, the Islamic populations have tended to lose in those wars. And so Israel ended up in recent decades controlling the Gaza Strip and also the West Bank of Jordan. And that's where the Palestinians live. Although a number of Palestinians actually do reside as Israeli Arabs within Palestine itself.
Mm-hmm.
They are obviously enjoying a much better standard of living under Israeli control than they would do if they were in Palestine, which would be either the West Bank or Gaza. So periodically you have these things flare up and then they die down and you get a new fresh round of conflicts, new Arab groups get formed, new conflicts get underway. The way I look at it is that we're back into a new round of conflicts. I'm actually very pessimistic about there ever being a long-term solution. I think you've got too many people making too many claims on too little land.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very difficult to see how that land can be split up between somewhere of the order of 15 million people,
yeah,
if you include Palestinians and the Israelis.
Yeah, well, let's get into your four predictions. Tell us about your first outcome.
Yeah, so these are not predictions. Remember, I do scenario planning, right? So
Scenarios.
These are scenarios.
My apologies.
These are possibilities.
Yep.
They're not things that are definitely going to happen, but they're things that we need to think about. So the first one, I just call business as usual.
Mm.
We will continue with this pattern that we've had for the last 75 years of flare up in violence, some sort of negotiated settlement which buys peace for a while, and then another flare up in violence. So the current Israeli government wants to destroy Hamas, which I think physically it can destroy the Hamas infrastructure, but it's not going to destroy the Hamas ideology, which is an ideology of opposing Israel.
Yeah.
So, okay, you get rid of the Hamas leadership. They'll come back in another form, but with the same basic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
That is one scenario that you could end up then with for the indefinite future, these rises and falls in the levels of conflict. I'm sorry to sound so pessimistic. This is going to be a very pessimistic program.
Yeah. It's all right. We're ready.
This is the reality
that
I think we face. So one scenario would be simply a continuation of what we've seen for the past 75 years.
Mm. So, you know, as you said, a flare up, which is what we're in now, and then it'll subside a little bit and then 5, 10, 15, who knows how many years up again.
Absolutely.
Your second theory or scenario that could happen is the one Israel. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so this is the idea that, in fact, you just fully amalgamate the two Palestinian entities into the State of Israel. In the same way, you've already got Arabs who are living inside Israel and doing work, etc., then the rest of the Palestinians could also live inside this greater Israel.
Mm.
They'd be eligible to stand for elections, etc. The long-term problem with that comes, ironically, from the Palestinian maternity wards, in the sense that the maternity wards are producing more and more children. Palestinians tend to have large families. And so over a long period of time, the Jewish segment will become a minority within this enlarged state of Israel, because there'll just simply be more and more Palestinians.
Mm.
The other aspect of this scenario is the return of religion back to the Middle East. If you look at the early pioneers on both sides, they were secular, quite often socialists. So in the case of the Jewish side, a lot of those early settlers treated Judaism as a form of identity, not as a form of major driving force.
Mm.
They didn't see anything special about Jerusalem and the holy places. It was just a place on the map. And so what we see now is a rise of conservative Judaism. And we see these big Orthodox families coming along. So we've got on one side sort of the more liberal, moderate Jews, whom we have been seeing on the streets before the current invasion. They're the ones who want to see change with the legal system and that sort of stuff, opposing the Conservatives, who are saying, we don't trust politicians, we like the current system, we do not want to have reforms.
Mm.
It's very interesting how in the Jewish side of Israel, you've got these big disputes now about the role of religion within the Israeli side. But at the same time, within the Arab side, we've got a similar transformation. So if you look at the early Arab nationalist movements, they tended to be fairly socialistic. Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Fatah, which was Yasser Arafat's group, which was the bulk of the Palestine Liberation Organization. These were socialists. Okay, they're Muslim, mostly, although the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, I think, was run by actually Christian Arabs who had become Marxists. I hope this is not too confusing.
A little bit.
So the Quran was important, I guess, but was not a major driving force. Then in 1979, you get the Iranian Revolution. So we move out of the Arab world, we go to Persia, Iran, and the Iranian Revolution brought to power the Ayatollah Khomeini, and suddenly Islam becomes a major political force.
Mm.
And then that flows across, they're Shia, flows across into the Sunni community. You get the Bin Ladens of this world, who are Sunni, but also very fervent Muslims. You know, we don't want to have women outside the house. Women shouldn't be employed in the sort of the secular market, etc. Very conservative approach, which, of course, we see now in Afghanistan, for example, with the Taliban, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, therefore, not only are we dealing in this second scenario with too many people making too many claims on too little land, but you've also got a religious overlay. But it's a religious overlay that cuts into both sides, particularly on the Arab side, because the Hamas, for example, the Islamic Resistance Movement, look at the title, Islamic Resistance Movement, loathes Fatah and the PLO.
Yeah.
So even on the Palestinian side, you've got these tensions between those who are really dedicated Muslims, motivated by the Quran or their interpretation of it, and others who are much more easygoing and would be very secular.
Mm. You're listening to Global Truths with Dr. Keith Suter, and today we're discussing the Israel-Palestine conflict and how it could possibly end. We're up to scenario three, the two-state solution. So that's the idea of establishing two separate countries for the two groups of people. How might that work?
Well, this, as I say, was first proposed by Britain as a way of trying to exercise its responsibilities under the League of Nations. The UN repeated it. And it's hovered around ever since.
Mm.
It gets rebranded from time to time. You know, George Bush picked it up, called it the Roadmap to Peace, but it's basically the original British proposal. The problem is that every time the proposal is revived, there's less and less land available for the Palestinians.
Yeah.
Because what is happening is that the Israeli settlers are taking over more and more land, particularly on the West Bank. In Gaza, they were all forcibly removed. There was a much smaller number of people involved there as settlers. Under the Oslo Agreement, which was an earlier peace negotiation by the Norwegians, it was agreed that the Israelis would withdraw from Gaza. That meant moving the settlers. That turned out to be a very bloody affair indeed when you had Israeli soldiers sort of physically manhandling the Israeli settlers.
Mm.
That was in Gaza. It's going to be a much bigger headache to try to move them out of the West Bank because a lot of them are, as I've mentioned, these are determined religionists. God gave this land to the Jews. So we shouldn't have Jerusalem betraying God's work in terms of promising land to the Jews. It would be a major problem to try to implement that two-state solution now. But that would be a third option, that we go back to where we were in 1937 with the original proposal by the British and just say, look, let's create two separate countries, equal standing in international affairs, which means the Israelis would have to allow the Palestinian entity to have perhaps its own defence force, enter into its own military arrangements, which could include also with Iran. Mm. That will send nightmares through the Jewish community.
Yeah.
But that would be the two-state solution. The two-state solution is the one that keeps being referred to. But the more you look into the practicality of implementing it, it's the one, by the way, I support.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that the Catholic Church, for example, also supports. The UN proposal, going back 75 years, was that Jerusalem would be internationalized as an international city, not governed by a Muslim or a Jew,
mm-hmm.
but would be presumably by a Christian or an atheist or a communist from Moscow or something.
well,
and of course,
unlikely.
That proposal gets objected to by both the Arabs and the Jews,
yeah.
who both got their eye on running Jerusalem.
Oh, my goodness.
So it just shows how complicated even that third one is, even though you end up with President Clinton, who talked about it, President George Bush Jr. Mm. also talked about it, Roadmap for Peace. It's the same basic idea, but it just gets dusted off, remarketed.
Yeah.
But the practical problems of trying to implement it would be just so difficult.
Yeah, it feels like we forget about it when things haven't flared up and we kind of go, oh, yeah, and then it just dribbles away. Look, the last scenario you say could be a possibility is the milk and honey. Now, that one sounds like it might be pie in the sky.
It is, absolutely. But I wanted to have an optimistic one on which to end my scenarios, which otherwise would be so gloomy.
Mm.
So the land of milk and honey is a phrase that appears in the Old Testament describing the Holy Land. And it looks somehow at a reconciliation between Jews and the Muslims. I've no idea how that would come about, but with scenario planning, you have to open your mind up to all sorts of opportunities. And I do, in my article, give a couple of examples. One is the example of Australia and Japan.
Mm.
In World War II, the Japanese had treated Australian prisoners of war appallingly. Huge amount of anti-Japanese feeling. And yet, within a few years, Japan became a major trading partner for Australia.
Yeah.
And at the moment, we're actually entering into a military agreement, perhaps, with Japan.
And if you'd said
to face the Chinese threat.
Yeah, and if you'd said that to people in 1945, they would have laughed you out of the building.
Exactly, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you can get that change there. The other one, of course, is France and Germany. For centuries,
mm.
the French and the Germans have fought each other, again, with different labels like Franks and Huns, etc. But essentially France and Germany. And now those two countries work very well within the European Union. So they can overcome old animosities. I might throw in another example, which I didn't include in the article, the role of the Swedes. When you think of Swedes, you think of ABBA, mm-hmm. Volvo cars. But 1,000 years ago, if you were living in England, you would have seen them as the terrorists of Western Europe because of the Vikings.
Yeah.
Going around with rape, pillage and murder.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Swedes come across as these sweet, gentle people who make cars and have good pop songs.
And furniture, can't forget IKEA. Look, there's no doubt, like we've discussed, it's a long and complicated conflict. How much longer do you anticipate we're going to see this conflict continue?
The current round, I think, could go on for a few weeks yet.
Mm.
My fear is that the Israelis have walked into a trap. President Biden tried to make that point to them when he was visiting the Holy Land a few weeks ago, when he said, look at the American experience after 9/11. We walked into Afghanistan out of a sense of anger and we were bogged down there for 20 years.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think the current round will last for 20 years, but I've noticed that the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, is actually talking about now, we're not going to negotiate a truce with Hamas. This is a war. So we're looking perhaps at a few weeks or even months. And of course, the thing to bear in mind for the Israelis is that the bulk of their army is made up of reservists. So we've got people who in a normal life would be driving taxis or running legal practices, medical practices, doing radio programs.
Mm-hmm.
They've all been mobilized. Now, if you take 250,000 people out of normal employment and mobilize them for warfare, it begins to affect the Israeli economy because they're losing crucial workers. So there are some limitations about how long the war could go for, but I fear it could certainly go on for a few weeks, if not a few months.
All right. Well, we'll be sure to get everything, all the latest information from you, Keith. You're so well versed in it all. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Global Truths is presented by Dr. Keith Suter and me, Sasha Barber-Gatt. Audio production by Niall Fernandez. Theme and original music by Matt Nikolic.